Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. One of the most famous photographs in rock history is the one on the cover of the album London Calling by The Clash. It shows bass player Paul Simonon smashing his bass guitar on the stage of the Palladium here in New York. Now, I was at that show, and it was amazing from beginning to end. The band asked Sam and Dave to be their opening act. It was 1979, and the soul duo's best years were more than a decade behind them. I was still in school. I sort of knew who they were because the Blues Brothers had covered one of their songs, but I didn't really understand how important they were or what their record label, Stax Records, represented. All I knew was that Sam and Dave left us a sweaty, happy mess. Now, if you don't know the story of Stax Records, stay with us and we'll fill you in. Of course, the end of that concert was at least as memorable. Capping off a raging, electrifying performance by The Clash was a stage invasion by some fans. So, yeah, the concert was loud. And the feedback from Simonon's amp at the end was even louder. Because one thing you can see in that photo is he neglected to unplug his bass before smashing it to bits. So, yes, loud. But not as loud as this week's Monday Night Football game, where the Seattle Seahawks fans set a new record for loudest crowd at a sports stadium. The title, and yes, there is such a title in the Guinness Book of World Records, has been bouncing back and forth between fans of the Kansas City Chiefs and the Seahawks. Now, does that sound like fun to you, or does that sound insane? We'll get two very different opinions about this new loudness war. And we've got live music in the studio from Lucy Wainwright Roach. Don't worry, it's acoustic. You'll live. But first, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, the Staple Singers, this band, Booker T and the MGs, these are just some of the soul stars whose careers were established at Stax Records. The label began in a Memphis garage and went on to produce hundreds of hit songs, and Stax was more than just a record label, according to Memphis music historian Robert Gordon. In his new book, Gordon argues that Stax was a refuge from the harsh racial realities of the 1960s South, and a reflection of the turbulent civil rights movement churning just beyond its doors. The book is called Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. And Robert Gordon joins me now, appropriately from Memphis. Robert, welcome to Soundcheck.
Howdy, howdy. Thanks for having me.
Now, you hear a lot going on in this song, Green Onions, by Booker T and the MGs. What's in here that's not just a neat pop instrumental?
Well, I think there's a lot of tension in this song. I think you hear the underlying racial animosity in Memphis. You hear the wariness of Booker and Steve of the public outside, you know.
Mm-hmm. Booker being the black keyboardist, Booker T. Jones,
right,
and Steve being Steve Cropper, the white guitarist. So it's a mixed race group.
Exactly, and it sort of began as an accident in the early 1960s, and the music worked, you know. So Booker told me if it had been a conscious effort, it would have been foolish to undertake this as a conscious effort at that time in that place.
So Stax, you know, both through this band and through the way the company would grow over the years, does become this kind of refuge from a Memphis that, like much of the South, is riven with racial strife. How did that happen? I mean, it's a white guy and his sisters, Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton, who are the founders of the record label.
I'm going to take it to Dewey Phillips for a second, who was a disc jockey in Memphis, a white disc jockey who transcended race, played R&B to a white and a black audience, was the first one to play Elvis Presley. And when Dewey would greet his audience, he would say, "All right, good people." So he wasn't talking to black and he wasn't talking to white. He was talking to good people. And I just I think that Jim and Estelle, the founders of Stax, were good people. And they said, there's this madness going on outside about people who hate people based on the color of their skin. But we're just going to run our business and deal with good people.
So they open up in this Memphis garage. Then they eventually take over this disused theater in what is... Well, it was a black neighborhood mostly in Memphis.
Change. It was a neighborhood in transition, change. The early days of white flight. Yeah.
Right. So how did Stax find its artists? Was it as simple as these are the people who walk in off the street through the front door?
It was as simple as that. They walked in through the front door into a record store. Mm-hmm. Estelle, the sister, established a record store on the candy counter of the theater, you know, like where you'd buy your popcorn.
Right.
And Steve Cropper was a clerk in that store. So they would kind of, you know, get to talking to people. And Booker said he always knew he could hear the music coming from the back of the place, from the theater, but he never could get back there until until the one session. But these guys would, Estelle and Steve, you know, were on the lookout. And the talent, can I just list the talent? Some of the talent that walked in the door?
Sure.
Walked in the door. I mean, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, William Bell, Otis Redding. It just goes, you know, the Mad Lads, these were people, the Barkays, people who lived in the neighborhood who walked in the door.
And you mentioned that Booker T, you know, he's hearing the music in the back, but he can't get back there till his first session. Was his first session the Carla and Rufus Thomas song?
Exactly right. He was in school, and David Porter, the songwriter who would compose a lot of the hits like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming with Isaac Hayes, he was in there with Rufus and Carla. So David went because he wanted to see what the session was like. When they said, "Hey, we need a baritone sax player," David went and got his friend Booker T out of algebra class.
Out of school, yeah, that's a great story. And the result is really the first hit for Stax Records. And as Robert Gordon is telling us, these guys, they just walked in off the street. Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla Thomas with 'Cause I Love You. That is Carla and Rufus Thomas with 'Cause I Love You, recorded in the Stax studio in the early 60s, early hit for the burgeoning soul label there in Memphis, Tennessee, the subject of the book Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion by Robert Gordon, who's with me on soundcheck. And again, in the background there, Booker T is playing baritone sax, not keyboard yet, although that would come later.
He didn't even consider himself a keyboard player. He considered himself a guitarist,
which
is wild
anything.
To think about.
Yeah.
He could play anything.
There are so many unusual and improbable stories of how Jim and Estelle, the founders of Stax, got to meet these various musicians. None of them more improbable than the story of how they met Otis Redding.
This guy in Georgia had cut a hit. And the people in New York thought maybe he would gel well with Booker T and the MGs. So they brought him up from Macon, Georgia to Memphis. And the guys were waiting for him outside. He pulls up. Everybody talks about the driver getting out and starting to unload gear. And they go, "Oh, no, man, it's okay. We're a recording studio, and we actually have the gear inside, and it's set up." Mm-hmm. So the guy brought in food and clothes. He just lugged the stuff for the star. And the star was a showman. And they couldn't really get a groove going in this studio. He was more of a stage player.
He would play the guitar behind his back and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was getting really frustrating, and people had to get out of the studio for their club gigs. Al Jackson, the drummer, had promised the driver he would give him a listen, and he comes running down at the end, and Steve Cropper says, "Okay, guy, you know, show me what you do." And when the guy started to sing, when Otis started to sing, Steve ran outside and got, you know, he had to tell Louis Steinberg, "Get your bass out of the car, man. I need you inside."
Yeah, you got to hear this.
And they cut what became his first single on Stax, "These Arms of Mine."
The story is so funny, but it sort of reflects really well on their openness to people.
Exactly.
who were unknown. And boy, did they profit from it, because Otis Redding would churn out hit after hit, including this one.
What you want, honey, you got it. And what you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for the respect when I come home.
To fade it out. I just want to hear the rest of that.
I'm dancing, John. I'm dancing.
Oh, man, respect. The original version from Otis Redding, recorded in 1965 on Stax Records. And Robert, I was saying that, you know, they would profit from their open minds and open ears. 2 years later, in 67, Aretha Franklin has a huge hit with it. So those publishing royalties are coming in. So as your story progresses, it progresses sort of in tandem with the sanitation strike there in Memphis, the racial divide, Martin Luther King coming because of the sanitation strike. And, of course, that's where he is assassinated. And the place where he is killed is a place that's kind of part of the Stax lore, isn't it?
Absolutely. The Lorraine Motel was about the only place in town where the Stax people could go relax. There was no air conditioning in the theater that was their recording studio, so they would go swim in the pool, you know, white and black together. They could get served in the coffee shop at the hotel together. And all their artists who came from out of town to record with them would stay at the Lorraine. It was black owned. It was downtown, not too far away. Yeah, it was their clubhouse.
And, you know, obviously the death of Martin Luther King, a major turning point for the country, but for Stax as well. Death rears its ugly head a couple of times. Mm. And, of course, the big one for them is Otis Redding. Is that really a turning point? Is that when things begin to go bad for Stax?
In a period of between the end of or middle of December and early April, when Dr. King's assassinated, they get three pieces of terrible, terrible news that would certainly have taken most companies to their knees. Those three news bits being the death of Otis Redding, and not only Otis Redding, but the Barquets.
Most of the band, yeah.
Who were kids from the neighborhood who had worked in the, one was a shoeshine boy in the barbershop next to the theater, you know, and they all had just hung out with the MGs, learned to play, had a hit with Soulfinger. They were the kids, you know, and so the next generation was wiped out with Otis.
You actually, in the book, you actually list the names and ages of everybody who was on that small plane that went down. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see 18, 19. And by contrast, Otis Redding and the pilot at 26 are by far the old men in this group.
It is absolutely heartbreaking. And the account I got from Ben Cawley, the survivor of the plane crash, just spine tingling. But the third piece of news is that a deal that Stax has signed with Atlantic, which Jim hadn't read before signing, and he had signed away ownership of everything that was put out. It was devastating news.
You talked to Jerry Wexler, who was the head of Atlantic, who did this deal with Jim Stewart and Stax.
Right.
And he protests that he knew nothing about it, that his lawyers slipped it in, and that when Atlantic was in turn being swallowed up by Warner Brothers, he said, hey, I want to do right by these guys and give them their master tapes. And the folks at Warner said, no, we have a deal and that's how we're going to do it. You make it pretty clear that you're not buying Jerry Wexler's story.
He told me that story that you just told me in answer to my first question to him, which was, you were in New York and Stax was this little label in Memphis. How did you hear about them? My question was as innocent as that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the first thing I asked him. And within about 60 seconds, he was defending, one might say, protesting too much.
Yeah. Well, you do say that. I think that's the exact phrase you use. He doth protest too much. So, as you say, it's a triple blow to the folks at Stax. And yet, it does not bring them to their knees. They, you know, they sort of
soldier on. They had a secret weapon.
And what was that?
That was a guy named Al Bell. He was what they called the Otis Redding of business.
Mm.
You know, he was, and I called him a rocket in wingtips. He helped Stax figure out how to come back from this devastation, which was to realize they had all the parts that they used to have. They had songwriters, they had artists, they had a recording studio,
mm-hmm.
and he put all that to work in creating the Soul Explosion, which was the simultaneous release of 28 albums and 27 singles.
And one of those songwriters would become a kind of game changer, a landmark in African American music, and that is mm-hmm. Isaac Hayes. And man, he just went from strength to strength to the point where, you know, he did the famous theme from the movie Shaft, which, you know, forget about winning a Grammy. He won an Oscar for this,
yep.
which was, again, simply unheard of. Possibly the most famous piece of pop music to have come out of Stax. Here is Isaac Hayes with the theme from Shaft.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on.
Isaac Hayes and the award-winning theme from the film Shaft, a high watermark for the record label Stax.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert, I said, you know, pop music. You make the distinction that Motown was making pop music. Stax, for much of the 60s, was making soul music. But as the 70s happen, as Al Bell is working his magic with all these radio stations, they really begin to become more diffuse, more eclectic. And it seems that as the house of cards goes taller and taller, the whole thing begins to waver and then eventually crumbles. What was at the heart of that?
I think that Al ultimately was motivated to give middle-class existence to black people who had been denied middle-class existence up to that point in time. Al wants to become basically what Atlantic had been to them
mm-hmm.
for other labels. So he is signing labels and signing artists and signing hits and distributing and releasing. And he begins to expand the staff at Stax. At one point, there's over 200 people on staff. The numbers got so big, things got out of control, and Isaac was this goose laying golden eggs every time. The whole second period of Stax is really built on the success of Isaac Hayes
mm-hmm.
as an artist, as a recording artist.
And on a cozy relationship with a local bank, which also turns out...
Again, you know, the improbable, the word improbable returns. It so happens that Stax is this stream of money, and a guy at the bank realizes he can do some embezzling, begins to forge signatures.
Mm-hmm.
Stax is overextended more than they know. And then, well, the ultimate thing is they make a deal with Columbia. Jim Stewart wants out. Columbia is the biggest distributor in the world. Al reaches the pinnacle of his achievement because now he can get his records everywhere that Columbia can ship them, or so he thinks. Because soon after they make the deal, soon after Jim Stewart cashes out, the deal with Columbia goes south, and Stax finds that no matter what it presses up and delivers for distribution, it's not getting in the stores.
Right.
CBS denies responsibility, but there's lots of evidence that records weren't getting in stores, and that becomes a stranglehold.
We're speaking with Robert Gordon, the Grammy-winning Memphis music historian, about his book, Respect Yourself, about the story of Stax Records. Why do you call it Respect Yourself? You say this song is Stax's legacy. Why?
Well, it's a beautiful and simple message, and I think it is the heart of what went on at Stax. When Jim and Estelle opened their door to black people, despite the city telling them not to, it was a matter of respect, you know, and respect is at the core of good relations between people. Mm-hmm. And that's what Stax was. And you hear that in the music.
Staple Singers with Respect Yourself. The book is Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion by my guest Robert Gordon, the Grammy-winning Memphis music historian. So, Robert, in sum, it's not just a Memphis story. It becomes an American story. Is it an American tragedy, or is there a second act?
Well, there's a third act. It's a story with two triumphs and two terrible tragedies, two fortunes made, both fortunes lost. And then the building was closed in 75. In 1989, they were tearing the building down. And then like 10 years after that, maybe 15 years after that, they began to rebuild the building brick by brick from the original design. And now stands the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, which is really just a front for the organization's educational efforts. It began as an after-school program for kids in the neighborhood to get help with their homework, and it's turned into a charter school with six or seven grades. Last year, the second graduating class finished. For the second time in a row, they had 100% college participation, you know, people going on to college.
Wow.
And one girl last year got a full ride to Brown. So there was a long, awful quiet on that corner that has been followed by the return of the spirit, frankly. I mean, it is the rehabilitation of the spirit of all the good that was at Stax.
Well, that's great to hear. And, of course, there is the music, classic American music from the vaults there at Stax Records. There is so much more that you'll find in Robert Gordon's book, Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. Robert, great to have you with us today.
Thank you, John. It's been a real blast, and you seem like a soul man.
Up next, Lucy Wainwright Roach may be the heir to a rich family musical legacy, but she's been building a career of her own lately, and she'll perform in our studio with her mom, folk singer Suzzy Roach, next on Soundcheck.
If there's time, I'll meet you by the old tree.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week on the show, we were talking about the perils of trying to turn your parents onto the music that you like. But in some families, music just naturally runs across the generations. Take Lucy Wainwright Roach, for example. You've probably heard her dad's music, Loudon Wainwright III, or her mom, Suzzy Roach, from The Roaches. Maybe you're familiar with other family members like Rufus Wainwright and Martha Wainwright. Well, Lucy stayed out of the family business for a while, working as a teacher, but 3 years ago she released her first album, and now she's back with a second. It's called There's a Last Time for Everything, and here is Lucy Wainwright Roach playing the song Last Time, live on Soundcheck.
Met you when the days were ours. We've been handed all the moons and stars, and told go forth your future's north, and your own breath will take you far. Well, some of that tale was so, and some of it we would outgrow, but side by side we rode that ride with each other always in tow. Everyone will always know you are a heart of mine. Between forever and one day there is the finest line. And I wanted to show you just a kid, and I never did. So now an ancient era ends, a few moments left for us to spend. You're just not quite still mine outright, and we will never be. Changing on a prayer, a wing, not graceful or true, just me and you. There's a last time for everything. There's a last time. There's a last time. There's a last time. There's a last time for everything.
That's Lucy Wainwright Roach, live on Soundcheck with her song Last Time. Her new album, her second, is called There's a Last Time for Everything. That's Lucy singing and playing guitar. Her mom, Suzzy Roach, is here with us as well, and will be joining in on guitar and vocals too. But Lucy, good to have you back here.
Great to be here.
So the first time you were here was when the first album came out 3 years ago. And you talked about how, you know, despite growing up with music on both sides of the family, that you tried to kind of stay out of the business as long as you could.
Yeah, I figured there were enough of us doing this.
So now, we could put a first album off to just kind of a fluke. But now when you've done a second, you know, are you now, is this like a statement of commitment finally?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, how long of a commitment? I'm not sure. But I'm certainly all feet in on the music thing at this point now. And so far, so good.
Right. Now, how did this record happen? Was this more planned or was this kind of spontaneous as well?
I knew that I needed it. It was coming up on a little over 2 years since my last record came out. And I really wanted to make a record, but I didn't have any songs. I'd been traveling around on tour and I'd sort of forgotten about the songwriting part.
Mm.
of the thing. So I
still
kind of
learning
that.
All the how to juggle all the different parts of the craft.
Exactly. Yeah. I was busy. So I had a friend, Jordan Hamlin, who lived in Nashville, who suggested I come down and just do a couple of songs and try to write some before I came down and see what happened. And I ended up kind of locking myself in my apartment and writing a whole bunch of songs, and then we picked our favorites and ended up with making a whole record. So it worked out better than I had imagined.
Now, you didn't just pick songs that you had written. You picked a couple of songs that other people had written, too.
Yeah, on the new record, there's one cover song, and it's a cover of Robin's song, Call Your Girlfriend.
Let's hear a little bit. This is what the original version of Robin's Call Your Girlfriend sounds like.
Call your girlfriend.
So that's a little bit from Robin, the original version of Call Your Girlfriend from the Swedish electronic pop artist. Lucy, what did you hear in that you felt would fit on your record?
Well, I love that song, and I love the music video that she did of it. I think is amazing, and I'd never quite heard a song that was saying that exact thing in that way. So I really love that song, and it turned out that Jordan also loved that song. One day we were riding in the car in between recording songs, and that was playing, and we both loved it, and we kind of looked at each other like, could we possibly? And we did. We just decided to give it a try. But I hadn't imagined that it would end up on the album, but we loved it so much that we put it on there.
Well, you know, it's nice to when a song has that kind of electronic sheen to it and all those layers of production, when you strip the thing down, you find out really what kind of bones the song has, so to speak. And as it turns out, in this case, pretty sturdy bones. Here's Lucy Wainwright Roach's version of that Robin song.
Call your girlfriend. It's time you had the talk. Give your reasons. Say it's not her fault. But you just met somebody new.
From my guest Lucy Wainwright Roach, some of her cover of the song Call Your Girlfriend by Robin. It appears on her second album, her latest, called There's a Last Time for Everything, which is out now. Lucy's here in the Soundcheck studio. Suzzy Roach, good to see you again as well.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So now this, you know, the whole family thing, it's got to be somewhat unavoidable. And yet, Lucy, it seems like there's a distinct lack of Roaches and Wainwrights on this second record of yours.
Well, yeah, I made it all in Nashville in about 10 days mostly. So nobody was around.
Okay.
Now, after the fact, we've learned some songs together from it. And
Suzzy, when Lucy was growing up and thinking that maybe she wasn't going to go into the family business of being a singer-songwriter, she was learning how to play guitar and how to sing, obviously. Was that from you? Did you teach her?
Well, she really didn't pick up the guitar until a little bit later. And, you know, I was pushing for her to be a banker. Honestly, I was not rooting for this music business thing, but she wound up actually the day after she got her master's degree going on the road with Rufus, and that was kind of the end of it.
But you did spend a couple of years teaching, Lucy.
I did, yeah, about 3 years.
Is there something about teaching and something about songwriting or performing songs that, you know, that those two things sort of inform each other?
Yeah, I think they're very similar jobs. because they're just kind of about trying to get a group of people to listen to you with varying degrees of success.
Right, right.
And, you know, you want people to sit down and be quiet, which is the same in either job. So I think I'd make a better teacher now that I've done as many shows as I have because I'm less shy and I don't know. I think I would be better at it.
You know, that's, I mean, if you think back to, like, good teachers that you've had, they all had something, and you could say they had stage presence.
Yeah, totally.
You know, knew how to perform in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a job. Lucy Wainwright Roach now with a second album to her credit. It's called There's a Last Time for Everything. So now the two of you are going to perform a couple of this next song together.
Yeah,
for
this
us.
Song on the record, Colin Malloy sings on it. And,
from the Decemberists.
From the Decemberists. And so he couldn't come with us today. So Mom is going to step in and channel him.
All right. The song is called Seek and Hide. It's Lucy Wainwright Roach and Suzzy Roach live on Soundcheck.
I fell in love last year. It's not a thing I do a lot. Pack up all my lonely habits and give it all I got. And when the winter came, I thought I would be different, but I'm not. I'm just the same old sorry kettle calling blackest pot. You gotta watch it all change. You gotta watch it all stay the same. I walk the morning shore to see what pieces I can find. Glue them all together, make a sailor's valentine. It's empty now, I know I should feel sorry, but I'm fine. I've got another losing, lagging paper clock to wind and watch it all change and watch it all stay the same.
Seek and Hide is the name of the song from Lucy Wainwright Roach, singing and playing guitar, with her mom, Suzzy Roach, also singing and playing guitar, live on Soundcheck. So the holidays are coming. For most families, it is a big family occasion. What about in the extended Wainwright Roach family? Is there kind of a traditional sing-along thing that happens around the holidays?
Actually, Sloane is having a Christmas show this year on the...
At the City Winery, on the 15th. That's going to be kind of a family combo thing.
How much of the... I mean, because the family is so sprawling at this point.
Whoever happens to be around, yeah. I guess. It's one of those kind of things.
An odd collection of Wainwrights and Roaches will definitely be there.
So that's the 15th?
That's the 15th.
At City Winery, right across the street from our studios. The new album is called There's a Last Time for Everything. It is the second and the latest from Lucy Wainwright Roach, who's been here with Suzzy Roach in our Soundcheck studio. It's great to have the two of you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And happy holidays.
You too.
I fell in love last year. It's not a thing I do a lot. Pack up all my lonely habits and give it all I got. And when the winter came, I thought I would be different, but I'm not. I'm just the same old sorry kettle calling black a spot. You gotta watch it all change. You gotta watch it all stay the same.
If you liked our session with Lucy Wainwright Roach, there's more at soundcheck.org. Up next, the battle for the right to claim the NFL's loudest stadium. We'll talk with a fan who's leading one side of that battle and a reporter who'll tell us about the hearing issues involved. Next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's a new record to beat in the NFL, but it's not for most touchdowns or interceptions. It's for loudest crowd roar at a sports stadium. A Guinness Book of World Records title that recently has been battled over by fans of two NFL teams, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Seattle Seahawks. Now, when we first spoke about that ongoing competition last week, the Kansas City Chiefs fans held the record at 137.5 decibels. This is what that sounds like. It's a little bit of fan footage off of YouTube from the October 13th record-breaking game from the Kansas City Chiefs at Arrowhead Stadium. Joyce Cohen wrote about this for the New York Times. Joyce, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
So how loud are we talking about here? When you're talking about 137 decibels, what's that?
137 is basically loud enough to cause immediate and permanent ear damage for a lot of people. I have to add, it's kind of a fake record. There are several ways of measuring noise, and this was measured in the way, it was a peak measurement measured in the way that would give the highest possible reading, and it was also right near the measuring device. So it's not the case that all the fans are going to be exposed to 137 or 130-something decibels for the entire 3 hours of the game.
Right.
The real problem is they're going to be exposed to very, very high volumes during the game regardless.
Well, this has become, you know, this has become the sound of American sports is, you know, you go to a baseball game, which used to be a very quiet affair, and there's booming music, you know, as each batter is approaching the plate and often in between pitches and stuff. So sports has gotten loud, and it seems like the leagues, like the NFL, supports this kind of battle royale between the Seattle and Kansas City fans, don't they?
The NFL spokesman Brian McCarthy said that ever since the league was founded in 1920, they have never received one complaint about volume, which might be true because maybe the fans are complaining to other people. I can give him dozens of people. I can name names of people who have complained that NFL games are uncomfortably loud and dangerously loud.
On the other hand, you know, if you're going to a game, presumably it's because you want to be there. No one's holding a gun to your head. You're a fan of the team. You want to be able to yell when your team scores a touchdown. You want to be able to boo when the opponent, you know, completes a first down pass or something like that.
Right. And as the NFL spokesman said, you're not going and taking a book out of the library. So sure, like if you go to a concert or if you go to a game, you do know there's going to be some amount of loud noise involved, which is... And on one hand, you can say it's a good thing because you know to protect your ears ahead of time. I think another problem is children are subjected to this. And, you know, it's tough for kids to wear earplugs. And so, you know, a lot of children are there at the game with completely unprotected ears. Occasionally, you'll see a kid wearing earmuffs, the kind that Drew Brees,
yeah, on his one-year-old, yeah. That was the Super Bowl like a year or two ago.
Yeah, I believe it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, okay. We're talking with Joyce Cohen, who writes for outlets like the New York Times and BuzzFeed, and Joyce joined us on Soundcheck previously to discuss her own experience with the condition known as hyperacusis. You can find that interview on our website at soundcheck.org, along with Joyce's New York Times article about these record-setting attempts at crowd noise in the NFL. That's also on our website at soundcheck.org. Now, Joyce, some of the quotes in your piece... The Kansas City Chiefs coach Andy Reid said he could, quote, feel the ground shaking, unquote, and later heard ringing in the ear that was not covered by his coaching headset. And another kid described it as, quote, so loud that the insides of you rattle, unquote. And both of them, I think, in context, were saying that like it was a good thing. You know, people go to get riled up. They feel like they're a part of the game when they're that loud. And in fact, you know, they are a part of the game if they're disrupting the visiting team's attempt to call a play.
Sure, and that's one thing about football. You can, in fact, make it loud enough so that the other team can't hear. I think the problem is that people believe it's harmless fun. People are truly coming at this from a position of ignorance. They have no idea. They finish the rousing game and they have ringing in their ears, and wasn't this a great game or wasn't it a great concert? And it may have been a great game, but they don't know that they are giving themselves permanent ear damage, and it's going to show up at some point. And I think truly, ignorance rules the day. People just have no idea. There's been no education about this. People know that cigarettes are bad for you and you're going to get cancer down the line. People know that getting a sunburn is bad for you because you're going to get skin cancer. People have no idea that ear damage is in their future.
And when people first started saying, hey, you smoke those cigarettes, you're going to get cancer. Hey, you get that sunburn, you're at risk for melanoma. A lot of the initial response to that was negative. Like, who are you to tell me that I can't smoke this cigarette or go out and get a tan or whatever? What kind of response did you get to your article from people who, you know, maybe think this is, as you said before, all in good fun?
The response is completely different from sports fans who have been talking about the wimpification of America. You know, it's very macho to go to the loud game. The response is different from those people than from people either who have hearing problems, people who know about it, people who are basically suffering from hearing problems because they had too much noise exposure mm-hmm. in their past.
Now, 3M actually saw the Kansas City attempt at setting the record as a teachable moment and distributed 30,000 sets of earplugs. What do you make of that?
I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, it's great they're passing out earplugs. On the other hand, earplugs are not that easy to use. It's not like you're out in the sun and you put on sunglasses.
Right, right.
It's more the case that they're finicky, little kids have trouble with them, you have to roll them up, you have to get them in properly, it's hard to wear them properly. So, and also the feedback I got was a lot of people took the earplugs but didn't wear them.
What kind of response were you getting from the scientific and the medical community?
Everyone in the field of auditory science knows that loud noise is damaging. There are some enduring mysteries. One is that some people are robust in their ability to withstand loud noise. There are some people who could go to rock concerts their whole life or who could be a season ticket holder at the game their whole life, and their hearing will be fine. but you don't know who those people are. And that is one of those mysteries in the field. There are a lot of other mysteries. Often tinnitus goes with hearing loss. Sometimes people have hearing loss without tinnitus, or they have tinnitus without hearing loss. There's so little that's known about the ear that it's really impossible to sort of predict what's going to happen to any individual.
Well, we do know that louder is better, according to some NFL fans, and right now it's Kansas City and Seattle sort of vying for the title. You can check out Joyce Cohen's article for the New York Times on our website at soundcheck.org. Joyce, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
Now, we spoke to Joyce Cohen, the New York Times writer, just last week, and already the story has changed again.
They once had the record for the largest outdoor stadium. Kansas City broke it last month. They'll be measuring to see if they can get to 137.5, the record here tonight.
On Monday Night Football, the Seattle Seahawks fans reclaimed their record for loudest crowd at a sports stadium with a decibel rating of 137.6. Your move, Kansas City. And joining me on the line from Kansas City is Ty Rauten, a.k.a. X-Factor. Ty is the founder of a Kansas City Chiefs fan group called KC Superfans, and he's one of the organizers of the Kansas City Arrowhead Stadium effort to claim that loudest crowd roar title. Ty, thanks for joining us.
What? Can you speak up?
All right, you're making fun, but it is a serious point. I mean, you got a stadium full of people, not all of whom have gone there, thinking they might potentially lose their hearing while they're watching their favorite team. You know, why is this so important to you guys?
You know, it's everything. You know, I'm one of those guys that I get busy living, I get busy dying, you know, and I'm a farm boy. I grew up in western Kansas on a farm. You know, I eat red meat, potatoes. I love bacon. Yeah, I smoke. And I drive in Kansas City during rush hour. I know it's not as bad as New York and stuff, but that's dangerous. So, you know, I've got a lot more serious things to worry about than, you know, hearing loss, you know, because that's some way down the road, you know. And if I need to, you know, it's cool to wear a hearing aid when you're older, you know, but in all honesty, you know, we're around loud noises all the time. And I've been to roughly about 330 some games, and my hearing's, you know, just as good as it's always been. I know people that went to Arrowhead for 50 years, you know, they're in their 80s, and, you know, they never have a problem hearing the question that I ask. They're not asking me what.
Although, you know, for 50 years, you know, there hasn't been a kind of concerted effort to be as loud as humanly possible, which, you know, now suddenly, you know, between you guys and the fans in Seattle, it's like, you know, who can be the loudest? And as Mike Florio from NBC Sports pointed out in an article, once you guys reach 137 decibels, which both you and the Seattle fans have passed, you're getting close to the point at which eardrums start to rupture. Now, you know, going from 137 to 149, which is that point, that's a big, big leap. But still,
still enormous. You've got to double when you get that high. You've got to double the noise just to move up one decibel.
One decibel, so, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
149 is never going to happen.
Yeah. But now, do you think if you had had some, you talk about, you know, being at 300 NFL games and your hearing's fine, do you think that if you had some sort of hearing damage, you might feel a little differently?
No. Like I said, I get busy living, you know, I don't worry about anything, because we never know how long God's going to give us on earth. You know, it can be taken away, you know, a minute from now, you know. And Arrowhead is the most amazing venue. I invite you all to come out, you know, and see this. You know, the tailgating, the family, you know, the experience of being so loud. We've been doing this since the 90s. We've been known as the loudest NFL stadium. We are a part of the game. You know, we cause false starts. You know, we cause quarterbacks to call timeouts, you know.
Right, right.
You know, we influence the game, you know, and what's most important is wins and losses in the NFL, you know. So if we can help our team win, that's what matters most to us. And we don't think about, you know, hearing loss or anything like that. And not even a thought in our mind.
So when they talk about the 12th man, you know, a loud crowd will, as you say, cause a lot of disruption for an opposing offense and sometimes for an opposing defense as well, and for communication between the coach and the quarterback, et cetera. So it does become a part of the game. I'll ask this question. I think I know the answer. Do you wear earplugs at any of these games?
Absolutely not.
Okay. What about, you know, if you're bringing... Would you bring your kids to these games and sort of, you know, maybe suggest that they wear some kind of protection?
My daughter comes to the games all the time, and I've been coming since I was a kid. My first game was when I was 10 years old, so no, I wouldn't put earplugs in my kids' ears.
So will you be trying to take the title back now that the Seattle Seahawks fans have just barely topped you guys on Monday night? Will you be... going at it again?
Absolutely. You know, and the Guinness deal to us was just icing on the cake. What we were trying to do was restore the crowd noise at Arrowhead to be the most intimidating in the world, you know, not only just the NFL, for opposing teams to come in. We've accomplished that mission. You know, Guinness was just a tool to make that happen. You know, the fans really rallied behind it and stuff, and you know, Seattle kind of has a bunch of advantages, you know, either weather elements, their stadium's built for it. Mm-hmm. They were using megaphones that are not allowed in the NFL. They got metal bleachers and stuff, and they barely went up to 0.1 decibels. You know, and they also had a Monday night game with two playoff teams and everything, you know. So, you know, eventually we'll come. And we'll smash that record probably next year and, you know, just officially end it. We'll set the bar so high that they won't ever want to even attempt it again because, you know, it won't happen.
Ty, I hope you're able to do that without blowing out either eardrums or vocal cords because it takes a lot of lung power to be that loud.
I'm more worried about my vocal cords. If you can't tell, I'm just a couple days removed from the game and my voice is still fighting to get back.
All right. So glad to hear that you're at least thinking at least a little bit about the possible consequences of this. Ty Rauten is X Factor. He is a founder of the Kansas City Chiefs fan group KC Superfans, one of the organizers of the effort to claim the Guinness Book of World Records title of loudest crowd roar at a sports stadium. Ty, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, guys.
Tomorrow on the show, the actor and musician Oscar Isaac is starring in the title role of the new Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis. We'll hear about his on-screen performances, the soundtrack produced by T-Bone Burnett and Marcus Mumford, and co-starring with both Justin Timberlake and a cat when Oscar Isaac joins us. Also live music from the Grammy-winning jazz vocalist and actor Dee Dee Bridgewater. That does it for the program today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.